Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. On this episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation I have with Armon Dagger, co-founder of HashiCorp. HashiCorp just announced a sale to IBM. Armon and I talk about that acquisition, as well as the inputs that went into selling from his side, including who he counseled on the decision, what it was like communicating with the employees, who all he heard from on the day that it was announced, among a number of other things. Armon and I also talk about the journey of HashiCorp and a number of the unconventional things that they did along the way, including launching initially with six separate products and how that led to HashiCorp's success. We also talked about him and his co-founder, Michel Hashimoto's desire to not be the CEO, including them swapping back and forth on a monthly basis before ultimately making the decision to bring in an outside CEO and Dave McJannet. We also talk about their principles for scaling culture, some of the things related to enterprise selling that were not intuitive, and his observation that it is easier to get divorced from a spouse than it is to get separated from a board member. A really fun conversation that you'll hear with Armon now. Armon, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks so much for hosting.
So maybe just to start, can you give a brief layman's definition to someone that probably isn't familiar with HashiCorp or your product suite, what it is that HashiCorp does?
This is the explain to my mom what yes, we actually
that's right.
do.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is always difficult given how technical the company is.
Yeah. But your mom's probably familiar with it. Maybe my mom. Less familiar with it at this point.
Yeah. So the way I like to describe it to people is if you think about, so obviously there's this massive shift happening to public cloud, right? So people are moving out of data centers. They're going to Amazon, Google, Microsoft, et cetera. Our view is that if you take any large enterprise, right? Think banks, insurance companies, governments, et cetera. They're not going to be in one cloud. They're too big for that. They do mergers and acquisitions. They have too big of an infrastructure. So fundamentally, they're going to be multi-cloud, meaning they're going to have some workload in their own data center, some in Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Oracle, et cetera. So their challenge becomes, okay, how do I do that in a way that's going to be both efficient and cost-effective, right? Because I don't want to have five different ways of managing, one for my data center, one for Amazon, et cetera. I want one way that can support my whole multi-cloud environment. That's effectively the layer we sit at. So we're kind of sitting at that point, enabling enterprises to adopt the cloud and do multi-cloud in a consistent way.
So across all those different clouds, there's a suite of products and considerations, infrastructure, kind of middleware, if you will, that is repeatable processes that have been codified and turned into software by you all that allows this to have a common lingua franca across
exactly.
All the different clouds, all the different services, anything you want to spin up, anything you want to do, all that.
Exactly. Yeah. So it turns into a portfolio of about 9 or 10 products today, depending on how you want to count. So each of those, you know, portfolio products solves sort of a different point problem. But yeah, it's exactly that. Each of these is sort of a fundamentally a multi-cloud problem. So you're going to have multiple tools, but the overall solution is looking at, hey, I'm a customer, I'm going multi-cloud. What are all the different problems I have to solve?
Makes sense. So you've had a big recent week, I guess, with a notable acquisition. So first, congrats on that, or an announced acquisition. I guess it's expected to close end of this year per IBM statement.
Yeah, we're expecting
it
to close this year, but yeah, a bunch of, you know, there's always the kind of classic regulatory uncertainty in there.
Yes, it seems like that stuff tends to go longer and longer. I guess maybe take me through the emotions you feel this week. I assume there's some like validation, some part of the journey's over in some way or different. It's going to be different than it was before. And so I imagine it's both validating and bittersweet at the same time. Is that fair?
Totally. Yeah. No, I would describe this week as a bit of like a whirlwind of emotions. It's exactly that. Honestly, in some ways, it is bittersweet, you know, to your point. It's, you know, you spend 12 years building it. It's your baby. It's sort of the standalone thing that's kind of like, you know, yours in its entirety. And that chapter comes to an end in some sense, right? You're joining a much bigger organization. But I think then the flip side of it is there's a ton of excitement, right? Obviously, we wouldn't have done this if we didn't think it was a good outcome for the people and the products and the company. And so I think, you know, we feel very aligned with IBM senior leadership in terms of the mission. And I think, you know, they're very excited about what we bring and the synergies of the portfolio. So to me, it's the, what's exciting is it's almost like, how do I take the HashiCorp mission, but put it on a platform that's 100 times the size, right? With 100 times the resourcing. And, you know, kind of get to see real what was sort of only in my mind's eye, you know, even closed. Right. There's still limitations we have in resourcing and size and scale that, you know, don't apply when you're 100 times the size.
Totally. Totally. So now going forward, so what happens for the next 6 months or whatever it's going to be till close? Do you, business as usual?
Pretty
and
much.
You just,
yeah. I mean, I think we remain fully separate, independent entities. So, you know, it's kind of business as usual for us. You know, build the same products, same mission, same priorities, focus on the customers. And, you know, very much kind of firewalled off. So there's a minimal integration team that can start doing some of the planning and integration sort of thinking. But effectively, it all has to kind of wait till the deal is actually closed.
Wednesday, did you, when IBM announces their earnings, did you and Dave and whoever else get in front of the company and sort of explain everything? Was that sort of the way it played out?
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't do it Wednesday because of just time zones. It's like by the time markets closed and announcements on it, it was already sort of late Eastern Seaboard, and you know we're pretty geographically distributed. So,
but do you have
Thursday
an email
morning.
Ready to go out?
Yeah. So email and blog posts and a bunch of those things went out right away to the internal audience, and then it was Thursday morning that's when we can actually do a company all hands and departmental all hands and really like spend time with people to help them sort of digest all the news. But yeah, there was definitely a period and window in there where you're like, the news is out and we can't get everybody together yet. You know, but I think it's like pretty quickly the company has sort of understood what's the rationale and what are the sort of synergies.
As you reflect on the totality of the process and being acquired, is there anything that stands out that you feel like you all did uniquely well to set yourself up for a successful acquisition? Anything that maybe you got to down the stretch and you're like, shit, I wish we built corp dev relationships with XYZ org or whatever it was, like any founders that might be most business, I don't know, 99.9999% of companies end up being acquired at some point, right? So even if you go public, like the end state is probably being acquired. No matter what scale you get to in the fullness of time, there's a very finite number that stay independent forever, right? And so I'm curious, anything that you would reflect on that could be helpful for people?
You know, that's an interesting one. You know, I think there's an old adage, which is the best companies are bought, not sold. And so I think for us, the way we sort of never geared the company to be bought, right? And I talk to founders who like they go in with that explicit intent. They're like, I'm not building a standalone business. Here's the 3 to 5 year plan and here's the target, you know, acquirer. And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong necessarily with that, but I think it's like it puts you at the disadvantage of like you're making a bunch of tactical decisions for a particular outcome that you don't control, right? And so you're like, well, what happens if that doesn't come to pass? Or the timing is wrong, or you know, whatever is the case, you could find yourself in a position that's sort of difficult because you optimize for that outcome.
Versus, psychologically, I just have to think there's the business execution operational sides of the puts and takes around that, but then just psychologically setting some time period, destination, when you miss that, it just has to be totally debilitating.
Totally.
Like for your ability to keep running the company.
Yeah, I would imagine. And I think for us, that's why we always sort of geared it as like, we're building this company for the long run. And I think I often got the question of like, well, you know, if you guys, why did you even go public, right? Because it's like, but that was the company we set out to build. Set out to build a standalone business that was meant to stand on its own 2 feet. Right? We weren't building a company to sell, right? It happened in the course of time that we found what we think is a great home and there was very logical synergy. So it makes a lot of sense, but it wasn't like we built the company for that outcome.
Yeah.
Right.
At what point, because you say built the company for that outcome, but once upon a time, there was a trade-off and we'll get into the founding stories, or there was like forks in the road that you were thinking about like, is this a research project, a lifestyle business, a venture-backed business. And so at what point in the journey did this become within the realm of ambitions or possibility that $6.2 billion, was that the price?
7.7 and then 7.7. Net of cash is 6.4.
Okay, so 7.7 sounds bigger. Yeah, yeah. We'll go with that. So 7.7 billion, like at what point in the journey did that even enter the realm of possibility that something of that quantum could be doable?
Oh man, not for many, many years. I mean, I think honestly, this rewinds all the way back to the origin. So Mitchell actually started the company 6 months before I joined. And at that point, it really was a lifestyle business, right? Like Mitchell had started Vagrant and it had existed prior to HashiCorp. So HashiCorp was really the vagrant company in some sense, if you go all the way back to 2012. And Mitchell had built sort of a consulting lifestyle business around Vagrant. And so the conversation between the two of us was like, well, what's the ambition here? If the ambition is Vagrant, the lifestyle company, I'm like, that's cool. That's a great, you know, business. You should have, you know, you, Mitchell, should have fun with that. But like, it wasn't super interesting to me as like, you know, what's the scale of that as a lifestyle investment? So the conversation really became, hey, what if the mission became this much bigger thing? What if we took on venture capital, you know, and shot for the moon? And that's when I was like, okay, that's interesting to me. And that's when I joined as a co-founder. So basically it was a rapid sequence of, I think I joined and we did our, you know, our first round was, you know, weeks after I joined basically.
Oh, interesting.
So I think we'd kind of had that conversation at the beginning to say like, what do you want this to be? If want it to be lifestyle, that's great. It's just not what I want to do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's super helpful. I appreciate you going into all that. So one of the things, I mean, you guys did a bunch of different things that I think go against the grain of conventional wisdom within Silicon Valley. One of
all
which,
of them.
I don't know, venture and outcome maybe. That seems within the realm of Silicon Valley, but a lot of the operational stuff are with outside of it. One of the most notable ones, I think, is I forget it. Maybe it's a YC adage or something about like singular focus and, you know, find product market fit and you guys. Did not have a singular focus, I think is probably the way that I would describe it. And you had a suite of products. How did that actually come to be? So you referenced Vagrant, that was the initial product, but how did you end up with, I don't know how many products by the end you had.
Probably have like 9 today. Our initial, if we want to call it the initial portfolio within the first few years was like 6 products.
Six products.
It kind of went from 6 to 8 to, you know, 9 or 10 now.
And so by the time you started selling, it was that. Now, how did you get there? And maybe what was the process of taking each of those individually from 0 to 1?
Yeah. So I think it was, you know, I think there was a few important decisions along the way, right? The first for us was like, do you take a single product or multi-product strategy? And obviously, conventional wisdom would say you never do a multi-product strategy, especially as a small company. Now, I think for us, the thing that made this all work was that it's not multiple products with multiple buyers. What we had was a single buyer strategy. We said, hey, there's going to be a DevOps persona. That person is going to be responsible for cloud infrastructure, cloud management, doing all these things. So the question for us was like, what are all the problems that person has, right? And so rather than try and build one monolithic tool that solves all of their problems, we said, well, we're going to build individual tools. Each one solves one problem that the same person has. So what we're not doing is building a relationship with 20 different people in an org. We're going to get to the DevOps team, build a trusted relationship and say, hey, Vagrant solved your first problem, but Terraform solved your second problem and Vault solved your third problem. And so it's by having sort of a singular channel and then building multiple things where you're building trust and then you're layering product after product in, that's what creates some efficiency to the model versus saying we're going to sell to 20 different people in an org, right?
So the decision of modularity there versus integration, like what was the thought process on that? Because other companies have taken the, well, no, we're going to have a bunch of different products, but it's going to be tightly coupled as a suite. And you guys very much had, it was more federated, right? There was some workflow and tooling that tied it together, but you could very much buy or download each of the individual products. So how'd you think about that?
So I think, you know, this goes back to some of the early thinking around, it wasn't clear to us at the time which of these products would be successful. And so if they're tightly coupled, it makes it hard to ever divest from them, right? So if you build it all in one platform, how do I kill a product if it turns out that thing doesn't have product fit? So it's, you know, it's hard to reflect on it now when these products sort of have fit. When you're sort of in that 0 to 1, you don't know what's going to stay at 0. So we felt like, hey, if we build these things separately, we can see what has resonance, what doesn't. And in fact, if we look back, there's multiple products that we ended up killing.
Yeah.
Because we built them, we're like, product market fit isn't right. People don't understand it. The workflow is wrong. And we killed those products. Like Surf and Auto were early products that we built, didn't have fit. We killed them. So by keeping them separate, it allowed us to sort of experiment in a way that was a bit lower cost, right? So we could play with it. The second thing is it gave us multiple insertion points to a company. So we might go to an organization who says, hey, we've really figured out secret management. We don't care about Vault. But hey, your Terraform thing, that's interesting, right? Or vice versa. Versus if they were all integrated, it becomes this whole conversation of, well, we need to bring in the whole platform. Part of your platform overlaps with investments we already have. And so now it just becomes a much more complicated decision of like, should we use your stuff at all? Versus if you say, hey, great, I'm happy you have a Vault solution. Why don't you just use my Terraform solution? And that worked really well because customers were like, okay, great. And that thing can play nice with the tools we already have. And we're like, yeah, you know, we always took a very open ecosystem approach. Our view is that over time, if we land you with, you know, Terraform, for example, we win a position of trust where you might say, actually, I don't really love our homegrown Vault thing. Maybe we'll take a look at yours. But that might be a year or 2 years after they adopted Terraform. But we now have a position of trust in a relationship versus if you had a whole platform. Platforms are notoriously difficult to sell. I mean, if you look at the history of startups, every generation, there's a graveyard of platform companies because they bring a ton of complexity, which means their operational burden is high. Their adoption curve is very complicated versus if you say, hey, these point solutions solve a very specific pain point and you don't need to boil the ocean to bring us in. It makes that adoption much, much easier.
And so finding product market fit for each of these things individually and going from that zero to one. So was it you or Mitchell would have an observation, hey, we had to do this. I assume other people have to do this. Let's build some commercialized version of this and throw it out there and see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. A lot of it was informed by me and Mitchell being former practitioners, right? So we started, you know, it's funny, before I even joined as co-founder, we literally sat down and sketched out the first six products, right? Broadly, what was the use case, the workflow, what problem were they going to solve? How would they work architecturally? So we basically had our roadmap on, you know, a few pieces of paper that would cover the next 3 or 4 years of the company. Because we had spent years building these solutions ourselves, and then it's not just in isolation. We talked to a bunch of our peers that, hey, what's GitHub doing? What's Slack doing? What's Stripe doing? You know, and so we had a sense of we're all solving the same set of infrastructure problems, and we all kind of have converged to a common set of patterns, but we're all home-growing the tooling. So we kind of had a sense of, okay, we know what the landscape looks like. We've built these tools before. All of our colleagues in industry have built these tools before. But no one has built it sort of for the masses, if that makes sense, like in a generic reusable way. They built it for their own homegrown need. So we basically sat down and said, let's just build these things in open source with a very heavy focus on developer advocacy and DevRel. So that's really where the product market fit, you know, mattered for us. It was actually not with the commercial products. For the first 4 years of the company, we actually didn't really have commercial products. We were just focused on open source adoption, open source growth. We obviously had some, you know, customers paying for support and things like that. But there really wasn't an enterprise version. It wasn't until 2016 that we had the first enterprise version of Vault, and 2017 that we had the first enterprise version of Terraform that were truly, you know, pure commercial versions, right? Before that, it was just a community focus.
I'd heard you say that a number of the competitors in the market, and I realize there probably wasn't any singular competitor, and in some ways you competed with your open source projects as well, was probably your biggest competitor, but that they were maybe more dogmatic in their approach, and you guys prided yourselves on being pragmatic in your approach. Can you contrast like what that actually means in practice and how it manifests itself in product development?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great one. And honestly, this is one of the biggest pieces of advice that I give founders, which is you got to be obsessed about one thing, right? And so you got to pick, are you obsessed about the problem you're solving or are you obsessed about your solution? And there's a very important difference between those two things, right? Because what happens with a lot of people is they obsess about their solution. They think this is the right way to solve the problem. I'm smarter than my customers. They just don't have, they haven't seen the light yet, right? In terms of this is the right way to do it. And the problem with that sort of dogma is, you know, most enterprises aren't starting from a position of blank greenfield, right? They have existing investments, they have brownfield, they have a mess of existing legacy technology. And so if you come to them with something that's super opinionated and you're rather inflexible and rigid about that, then it makes their adoption often impossible because they're like, well, do I really want to change the way the entire enterprise works to bring your tool in? Like, no, right? I need your tool to sort of fit into what I'm doing. So I think what we tried to be, and you know, we talk about pragmatism as both being one of our principles, but also our TAO, right? So our design philosophy of our products as well. Because our view is we should have an opinion, but it should be loosely held. So all of our tools has an opinion that says, hey, we think this is the right way infrastructure should be managed. But that's okay if you don't agree or doesn't fit in your environment. We're building flexibility into the design of the product to sort of accommodate other opinions, if you will, right?
Is there a way that that manifested itself, a tangible example of something that maybe you thought from a principled perspective was the way things could be done and you just found out in the market, the customers told you like, hey, not quite, and you had to iterate on it?
Yeah, so I'll give a very concrete example of this, right? So if you kind of rewind, you think when we started, it was like 2013, really. that was sort of the heyday of configuration management, right? So think Chef, Puppet, CF Engine, Ansible, right? They were all sort of reigning supreme. And I think there was this model in people's minds of the way we should manage infrastructure is a sort of very long running, you know, VMs that you run tools like Chef and Puppet on continuously to patch them, update them, et cetera. This is sort of a classic model of how infrastructure was managed historically. Our view was, you know, this doesn't actually make sense in a cloud world because it's super cheap to, you know, create and destroy VMs all the time. So why bother running things for months or years at a time? Like use it for a day, a week, a month, and then kill it and create something new, right? It's costless to do in the cloud. So we had this vision, this philosophy of what we call sort of immutable approaches to management, right? You know, the immutability being I don't upgrade a server, I just destroy it and I create a new one, basically, right? This was a pretty radical approach for most IT management, right? Most IT orgs are used to things running for years at a time. They have patch management practices, et cetera. So when we built Terraform, we held this opinion and we built Terraform around it. So Terraform's very much modeled around the idea of immutable infrastructure, right? When you make a change to your server, Terraform's going to destroy your server and create a new one for you, right? It's baked into how it works. As we came to our customers, we realized they're like, yeah, that's a great idea, but we have all of these applications that can't tolerate that. They weren't designed with immutability in mind that you're going to cause data loss, you're going to cause outages for us. So that opinion, while great and while interesting, doesn't work. And so we sort of said, okay, great. Well, how do you accommodate that? Well, we're going to go do tight integrations with Chef and Puppet and Ansible and Salt and bring in those solutions and say, okay, great. Use Terraform in conjunction with those things. So if you have, you know, traditional, more traditional infrastructure, great. Terraform can provision it and then you can do these long-running orchestrations for the long-running VMs using those tools. As you modernize and go to immutable practices, great, Terraform will meet you right there as well, right? And so we can kind of take customers on this journey from, hey, you have a traditional approach to sort of a more modern approach. And it took many years for some of our customers to sort of see the benefits of that. But now we work with huge banks who are like, yeah, you've actually solved what used to be one of our biggest pain points on patching, where it used to be thousands of people patching every month, to now it's fully automated and we can nuke and pave our whole infrastructure every 30 days. So, but that's the reality, is it took 5 years to take these customers on a journey, right?
Yes. Like, so layman's version of that is you saw the path of progress and where things were going and your solutions served that. But instead of being dogmatic about, hey, take it or leave it, we don't want to, that could be considered a competitor because it's a different way of doing something to a similar outcome. Let us partner with what ostensibly could be a competitor. Let them do that, and we're going to capture the net new way of doing things that we think will be faster growing and future proof in the coming years.
Yeah, and rather than even, we don't even think about it as a competitor. We said it's just a complementary model of infrastructure management. How do we bring these things together and say, okay, even if you're in sort of the old world, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to use the new tooling. So let's just integrate these things together and make them play nice so that you can say, great, both of these can coexist. Because the reality of a complex enterprise is it's never one or the other, it's both.
Yes. So maybe competitor is the wrong term, but something that was trying to solve a similar outcome in a potentially very different way.
Correct.
And so partnering with them rather than just being dogmatic about, no, you have to do it our way rather than...
Exactly. Yeah. Because the reality of these enterprises, you know, I joke, if you look at an enterprise, I think about them like a tree. And what I mean by that is like if you saw down like a big bank, they have every ring of technology still at play.
Sure.
Nothing has ever gone away. At the very middle, you still have mainframes. You have
credit
bare
cards
metal.
Amex credit card still runs the North Carolina mainframes,
exactly.
I think, today.
Yeah. So it's like, I think people have this view of like new tech comes out, enterprise adops it and transforms their whole business. You're like, it doesn't work like that at all. It's just yet another ring in
the
tree.
It's a layer cake that keeps building on itself.
Yeah, you're going to have your Kubernetes thing talking to your VM, talking to a mainframe, right? Like every layer of it is still at play.
Yeah. So the six products you guys initially launched with, they in hearing you tell the story, it was not an overnight success for any of them, I guess. Can you talk through... I've heard you say that maybe there's three different journeys in like the product evolution that you went through, and maybe in the first year of all of them, it was like hundreds of downloads, and most of them might have been you and Mitchell. But can you talk through like the confidence in just iterating maybe on the product and just staying the course without the data points? And then what were the next steps in the journey?
So this is the hardest thing, I think, about the whole thing. And founders ask me this all the time, right? Which is, if I look at all of our products, except for Vault, and we'll talk about Vault, they all went through this sort of, I'll call it period of despair, which is like in our mind's eye, we're like, we think it's a great product. We think they solve, you know, a great, you know, hard workflow problem in an elegant way. So we build these things in open source, you put them out there, and almost invariably with all of the products, what you see is almost a flat line of adoption for the first year or sometimes 2 years, where, you know, a tiny bit of download, maybe a tiny bit of GitHub interest, but relatively sparse, right? You wouldn't look at these things and say runaway freight trains of success, right? And, you know, part of the challenge to us was always like, how do you get conviction that you're right or you're wrong, right? Because they look very similar from the data.
Yeah, sure.
For the first 2 years.
And probably wrong, at least based on the numbers initially, right?
Exactly. Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. It looks wrong, right? You look and you're like, well, nobody cares, clearly. No, yeah. GitHub downloads, no traffic, et cetera. So, you know, I think it's a few things for us. One of the things that becomes really clear is it's important to understand, like, what's the reaction by, I'll call it, you know, the, you know, for lack of a better term, the smart kids.
Yeah.
Right. And so we had good relationships with a lot of these folks who are on sort of the bleeding edge of defining how cloud infrastructure should be managed. And so we'd go work with these people and say, hey, here's this tool we built, Terraform. What do you think about it? Right. And, you know, for some of our tools like Terraform, people were like, this could change the world. Right. Like, this is super interesting. Yeah. It has these feature gaps. Yeah. It has sharp edges and bugs and whatever. But you could see the excitement and people were willing to like try and be a part of that journey to make these things work because they could see the opportunity. With other tools like Surf, for example, that we built that we had to sort of kill because it didn't find fit, you know, people were like, what does this do exactly? And you're like, okay, if the smartest people we know are like, what does this do and what's the problem it solves? It's a bad sign.
Yeah.
So I think part of it was, it's your internal conviction that, you know, hey, do we think this is right? Part of it then is external conviction from a number of people that you trust their opinions, basically, right? And then the third layer of it becomes obviously sort of the, I'll call it the telemetry data of downloads, traffic, whatever.
Sure.
But that's going to be what we find is consistently a trailing indicator. Like, it's not going to be a leading indicator of anything. So, you know, it was some magical mix of those things. And then frankly, it takes just a little bit of unreasonable conviction, right? Like, Terraform is a great example. We had multiple conversations with our board where they're like, it just looks like this thing isn't going to go anywhere. Why don't we kill this product and move our engineering resources elsewhere? Right? Which is crazy. You look at it now and you say it's like our most broadly well-known product. But we had many board discussions where they're like, why do you even bother?
And so did you mentally, like in going through, I mean, once you got some level of validation from the cool kids that Surf wasn't the right fit, but Terraform was super interesting and had feature gaps, did you pick some point in the future to like check in? And I'm sure incrementally along the way you're like checking the downloads and all that stuff, but just psychologically so that you're keeping your own sanity, how did you go about picking a point in that was far enough in the future that you felt like you could get there but also within a reasonable enough time frame that you're not wasting your time?
Yeah, I mean, it honestly wasn't that long. I'd say with both of the products we ended up shuttering, it was about 6 months. So we give ourselves 6 months. We sort of launched it. We said, we'll iterate on a few versions of it. We'll talk to users, customers. We'll get their feedback. But like, time is not your friend as a startup. So we were like, okay, you got to make a decision and move on because you don't have unlimited resources. So Surf was pretty quick. I mean, I remember it was about 6 months after we launched it. Me and Mitchell sat down and we're like, we think we got the abstractions wrong, right? And again, this goes back to, are you obsessed with the problem or the solution? And so I think as we went and started talking to all these customers, what we validated was, yeah, the problem is real. Everyone kept articulating, hey, how do we think about network automation? How should we handle, you know, large scale fleets where you have failures in the cloud? So everyone kept re-articulating the problem. But then when we would explain our solution, they're like, eh, it doesn't make sense. So we were like, okay, what are we obsessed with? Problem or solution? And so we said, it's the problem. So we said, great, Park Surf. We went back to the drawing board, and what we ended up building was the successor to Surf as Console, which Console is now a very successful product for us. But again, it was because it was an obsession with the problem, right? We said, you know what? We were excited. We loved the solution. In fact, Surf is still one of my favorite pieces of technology, but it was the wrong solution for that problem.
So as these things are being launched into the wild and getting put on GitHub and all of that, how much of your time or how much of the success that ultimately came was rounding out the edges of the product and sort of spent, you know, making it more feature rich for the people when they came to realize this was the future versus grassroots evangelism, DevRel, all of that? Because I assume you picked, you felt like this was the path of progress one way or the other. And so in getting there, which one do you attribute more of the success to?
Oh, man. Those are almost intractably linked.
Because I assume that the DevRel is feeding into the product development and
bingo.
All that.
Exactly. I mean, it was like that feedback loop was so, so critical, because you would go to whatever, a meetup group, a conference, whatever it was, and you would talk about the product, and then someone would ask a question. It was like, hey, does the product solve X, or can I do Y with it? And then immediately you're like, well, that's a great question or feedback. We should feed that back into roadmap. And you're like, it doesn't today, but give me a month and the next version will, right? And so that feedback loop became super critical to know what to actually build was tied deeply into the developer evangelism of it. So it's almost hard for me to untangle the two, because it's like, you can't build a product roadmap in a vacuum. I mean, you can, it's just going to be a bad one. Right. So I think it's like, and because we were so driven by developer grassroots adoption, it was like, that was what drove our roadmap for many years.
Was the North Star or the ICP, as you were thinking about it, were you solving at that point in time for the cool kids and thinking that what they do today, everyone else will do tomorrow? Or were you also trying to get in front of the, not to disparage JP Morgan and Bank of America and, I don't know, LVMH and other big enterprises as well, and trying to cross-validate the two?
So actually, I think the two are pretty linked, because if I look at any of these big organizations, I don't think about them monolithically. Like within them, there's the cool kids within any of those banks, right? That they're defining how the bank is going to do this at scale. You know, but they might be the first 100 people where the bank has 10,000 developers. So to me, it was super important to get to those people. In fact, some of our most valuable design partners were those, you know, the cool kids inside of these big enterprises, the eBays, the PayPals, the JP Morgans, because it's like, if it's going to work for them, that's going to set the tone of how the rest of the bank is going to operate. Right. So actually, the interesting thing is almost never for us, not, I won't say almost never, rarely was the cool kids like the small startups in Silicon Valley. Because their scale challenges weren't anything close to the enterprises. You know, you think about most of the startups, it's like, great, you have 50 servers. That's
true.
You know, you go to talk to a bank that has 80 data centers and a quarter million, right? Like, it's just a very different scale of infrastructure. So for us, it was, how do you get to the cool kids in those enterprise customers? Because they're the ones that actually have the scale problems, right?
I heard you say that you actually knew your first 1,000 customers by name, and I'm not sure if that's a hyperbole to describe like being super close to the customers, or if you actually did know the first 1,000 by name. And how staying close to them, I guess, one, is that a factually true statement or sort of a allegory for how you went about thinking about staying close to it?
So I'd say, well, my face memory is better than my name memory, but I would probably recognize our first 1,000 users by face, if not many of them by name, because some of them have come to, you know, events like HashiConf, you know, 8-9 times. So no, it's very much factual. I think people often ask me, what are the tricks to building community? Like, what's the shortcut? And I'm like, it's pounding the pavement, it's miles in the air, it's, you know, it's conversations had with people and hands shaken, right? Like, there's no shortcut. So when I look at the early years, it was me and Mitchell spent a quarter million miles on a plane going to meet with customers, going to conferences, speaking at meetup groups, right? Like, just pounding the pavement, right? Because when you think about like getting to those cool kids, building trust and getting them to say, hey, I'm going to bet my company's infrastructure on a product you released 3 months ago that barely works. That's a very high level of trust. And that person needs to have very high conviction that they're not making a career ruining mistake. Right? Like, because this isn't like, oops, it failed. You know, it's like, it's your core infrastructure. Right? So it required very high levels of trust and conviction. And I think oftentimes, you know, a deep personal relationship with some of these folks. And I look back to actually some of the organizations like Twitch, where, you know, I'll never forget, we had this one meeting where, you know, Twitch was one of our first large scale deployments of console. And at the time, the largest test we had done was to run console, maybe like 200, 300 machines, which to us was big infrastructure at the time. And we had this meeting with Twitch. They're like, hey, we really like this tool. We've tested it. We think it will solve a big problem for us. Will it work for us if we run it on 3,000 machines? You know, and at the time, this was like 10 times bigger than anything we've ever run on. And my answer, you know, trying to be as honest as I could, I don't want to promise things we can't deliver. I said, I don't know. And, you know, that was fine. They were like, okay, we get that. You know, you know, and they're like, can we work through this with you? Do you have commitment to help us be successful? I said, I don't know, but, you know, we'll make you be successful. And so we worked through all the technical details, et cetera. Now, I won't forget, after that meeting, the team lead of that pulled me aside and said, you know, that was a great meeting. We're super excited about the technology. But if I give you one piece of advice, you shouldn't have said, I don't know. What you should have said is, we're committed to make it work for you.
Mm.
Because he's like, this is such a critical layer for us that this is make or break for us as an organization. And so I don't know is not a confidence inspiring answer. Right. And we get it. You were trying to be technically honest and not, you know, blow smoke. But, you know, I think what we needed to hear from you is a conviction to our success. And so that was a profoundly impactful meeting for me. And it changed the way I interact with a lot of our customers, which is, it makes you realize the bedrock, a lot of this stuff is trust. Someone saying, can I trust you that I'm going to make a bet with my career that this is the right technology? And you need to look them in the eye and say, yes, you know? And, you know, it's been a great relationship with them. They were, you know, huge user, advocate, customer, you know, still are, right? So, but it was just, it was a meeting like that that was really very impactful in how I think about, you know, how you engage with customers.
Yeah, it goes back to what are customers actually buying? And it's some combination of the software, the service, the trust, the confidence, all that stuff is intertwined in so many different ways.
Exactly. Yeah. Enterprise is so much of it is really about trust, right? And that's why I think there's honestly no substitute for some of these meetings being in person, right? And why, you know, it's valuable to spend so many, you know, miles, frankly, in a plane is it's like, you got to shake their hand, look them in the eye and say, you know, your success is my success.
How did you staff against 6 different products at launch? Like what was the actual org structure around it? Did you have like GMs of different products, or did each group have different product and engineering teams responsible for it? How did that actually work?
I mean, it evolved a lot. I mean, in the early days, it was crazy. I mean, we had 15 people with 6 products. So you didn't need a GM when you had 3 people on each product.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so I think, you know, from the early days, we were thin, but we were a lean and mean team. And we worked really hard to like, how many libraries can we share? How much code can we reuse across projects? Because we didn't have the resourcing given how many products we had. Obviously, as we got bigger, we could put a lot more staff on each of these products. So it got a little bit easier. And then we went through an evolution, right? For a long time, we were functionally organized, right? So we had, you know, product engineering, design, sort of functional groups. Then right around our IPO, we reorganized into more of a GM model. So then we actually had product GMs for their infrastructure line, security line, applications, networking, et cetera. And then very, very recently, actually as of February of this year, we actually reorganized back into a functional model, right? And so I think it's each one of those things. I don't think there's ever a right org structure. It's about what are you trying to solve at any given time, right? So for a long time, we were lean and mean, so functional was the right model. Then at some point, we got a lot bigger, and it was about how quickly could we make decisions and allow the products to run with independent roadmaps. So it made sense to flip into sort of a GM-ish model. And then now, as we think about sort of as we're delivering more of our products and services as a cloud service and through an integrated platform, it's about how do you drive a set of integrations and consistent workflows across the products so it makes sense to flip back into a functional model so you can think more horizontally rather than kind of vertically. So I think at each point in time, we were sort of solving for a different problem, and the org structure was designed to help solve for that. Mm.
When you move to a GM model, how do you think about the shared commonalities and services that you want to have across an organization versus the autonomy that you want to give that group to make decisions? How did you guys kind of balance that?
That's a super tricky one. So I think one of the keys for us is we actually had a few horizontal groups. So we had the 4 product verticals, but then 2 of our key horizontals. One was a platform team. So they owned all of our shared non-functionals around, you know, our cloud service, billing management, you know, user identity, things like that. So a bunch of core services were owned by a platform organization. And then we had a shared security team who was responsible for things like application security and compliance and all of those kind of things that are sort of shared concerns.
Mm. How did you end up with 6, then 9, and not 3 or 16 or 26 on the product set standpoint? What was the landing point there? I realize some were deprecated along the way, but how did you sort of land on that?
So we started out basically when we started in 2012 to 2013, we basically sketched out what we thought was an original portfolio of 6 products. And the way we got there was basically we said, okay, if we segment the entire sort of SDLC, the life cycle of building and managing a cloud application.
Software development lifecycle.
Software development lifecycle. We sort of saw that there's these 6 big buckets for us, at least, They were like, okay, you need Vagrant on dev tests, you have Packer on image management, you have Terraform on provisioning, you know, Vault on security, Console on networking, Nomad on app deployment. So we started there with those six and said, these are the big pillars. Actually, ironically, we didn't start with Vault there. I'll come back to that one. We had Auto there and we had Surf. So we had these other pieces and we said, okay, let's go build the initial portfolio of six. So along the way, for example, like I mentioned, we built Surf. We realized it was wrong. And so then the successor to Surf became Console. So you went from the vision of six to now you have seven, right? And then we had this other product, Auto, which our view was like, hey, as we started building seven, we're like, this is really complicated. Customers are going to struggle to integrate seven different products. What if we had an integration product that glued them all together? So that became an eighth that was then Auto, right? Mm-hmm. So we had these eight. So we sort of built those out and then realized, well, Auto and Surf actually, you know, didn't have the product market fit. So then they went away. So it really came back down to the six. That was the core portfolio, if I want to call it that, from sort of 2015 until about 2020. So for 5 years, we were just focused on no more net new product, add depth and breadth of capability to existing portfolio. Along the way, though, as we were talking to customers, we kept uncovering new problems, right? So we said, hey, we built Vault for secret management, but we have, what about human users? How do they get access to systems? That created the opportunity for us to add a new product, Boundary, that we released in 2020. And then we sort of revisited the Auto problem. Again, it was, are we obsessed with the problem or the solution? Auto, the solution was wrong. But the problem of how do we simplify, you know, the consumption of cloud infrastructure was still real. So that's why we ended up building Waypoint in 2020 as well to say, okay, this is kind of V2 of Auto. How do we simplify it for developers who don't care about the details of cloud? They just want to build an app. So we said, let's try again with Waypoint. So we ended up with adding those. And then we ended up acquiring a company, Blue Bracket, looking at, hey, great, we have this vaulting solution, but how do people find all the secrets in their environment? So it was a logical adjacency. So it was some combination, I would say, of part of it was vision-driven of what do we think are the key building blocks. Part of it was just customer-driven of their coming to us and saying, hey, we love Vault, but can you help us find the secrets we have in an environment? And so, you know, some of that became more natural to do through M&A versus build.
The transition point of going from hunting, if you will, to farming, like the hunting being building, shipping all these new different products, farming being rounding them out, getting them to full feature, figuring out monetization and all that. Why and when did you make that transition point?
Yeah, I mean, I think really we made the flip in sort of late 2015. So I think that was a milestone for us where we said, you know, when we raised money from the board, you know, from our investors, what we told them was basically, we're going to spend the first few years of the company fleshing out the portfolio, focusing on community adoption, and kind of getting to, I'll call it the MVP of the vision, right? You need these six pieces to sort of be able to draw the line end to end on app delivery. So we said, we want to be able to draw the line end to end, and then we're going to focus on fleshing it out, commercialization, et cetera. So we basically promised our investors that's what we'd do. And so first few years, that's pretty much all we did. Was every few months we were launching a new product. We got to our first ever HashiConf, which is our big user conference. That's when we launched the last two products in the portfolio. And so that way we had sort of completed the arc. And I'll never forget, literally the week after the conference was when the board emailed us to say, hey, that was a great event. Love the new products, love the energy of the conference. Can you tell us what HashiCorp the business is now? Because we know what HashiCorp the like open source projects are.
Yeah.
But what's HashiCorp the company? And that's the moment in time where it really kicked off a soul search for us to say, okay, great. What does HashiCorp the business look like as opposed to HashiCorp the set of, you know, open source projects that represent the vision?
I had heard that along the way, fundraising maybe got far easier when Docker came into existence and people were just like, okay, well, you're a derivative or a competitor of Docker along the way. And so I guess I'm curious, as you look back on the product journey and the desire to go into monetization, at what point in time was it that Docker took off? And how was that trend beneficial? Like, did it give you more time just to focus on the open source and do this stuff? Or did you need to react to the commercialization because of Docker and what was going on?
Yeah, totally. You know, it's funny how these things work out. Yeah, when we did our Series A, that was probably the most difficult fundraise we ever did because people were
that was Mayfield?
Like, that was Mayfield who led it, yeah. But we talked to pretty much every, you know, Silicon Valley name brand. And the challenge was people were like, they're like, oh, infrastructure for enterprise, like, this is a cold, dead space. Nobody cares about this. Like, why would you bother? Plus, you guys are multi-product. Like, are you crazy? Like, plus we were remote at the time. So we're like, you're a totally remote company. You want to do open source, you want to do multi-product, and you want to invest in a dead space. It was like every red flag.
And you were how old at the time?
22.
22, yeah. So
yeah, and they're like, and you guys, yeah, exactly, graduated 3 minutes ago.
Yes.
So, you know, I think most investors looked at us like, you know, we had a third eye or something.
Yeah.
So I think it was a super difficult fundraise because nobody cared about this space. You know, ultimately, we got there with Mayfield, you know, and I'm super thankful because they were, you know, deeply technical. They understood the whole vision. You know, we had a great partner, Robin Vasan, who led the deal, who was very connected to the developer community. And I think he had a thesis that's like the adoption of these tools is going to be led by, you know, practitioners. So that's why open source is super important. It's like remote is going to give you access to talent in a way that you won't have if you were Bay Area only, which most startups were at that time. And it was super competitive in that market. And his like the portfolio approach will actually be a strength over time because you're going to build a trust and be able to layer multiple technologies. So, you know, I think he really saw why we were had conviction about those things. And he was close enough to developers to sort of help make that bet. And so I think it was Mayfield and GGV who led the A and really sort of were bought into that vision. Now, I think as you get to the B, it's exactly what you said. It was like it became way easier because Docker exploded on the scene.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Docker had this organic, explosive, you know, growth by the developers, you know, in terms of driving adoption. And, you know, that drove, you know, a crazy, you know, skyrocketing valuation for them and an ultra competitive fundraise round. And so all of a sudden you had folks that felt like, hey, we didn't get into Docker. What else is the other Docker?
Yeah.
Right. And so it's like this boring enterprise infrastructure company that was HashiCorp that we didn't want to talk to last week. Huh. All of a sudden they're like, wait, you're doing enterprise infrastructure. That's so cool.
Yeah.
And so overnight it changed what the perception became. And so it became much easier all of a sudden to actually go and fundraise because people cared about the infrastructure space all of a sudden.
Mm.
But it's just interesting
yeah. You
know, how much of an impact that made.
Yeah, well, and that was when we participated, right? That was
yeah.
when Redpoint came on board. So we're appreciative of that. Yeah, it's every successful company, I think, maybe with one or two exceptions, has a very difficult fundraise, and it's a very humbling experience, I think. And I think every company, I don't wish it on anyone, but it does ground, I think, entrepreneurs when the things are going well. It gives more pragmatism of like, hey, well, I remember what this is like the other way, and so let's be a little bit more rooted in the partner we pick, the valuation we set, the ambitions we want to go about. I don't know if that was your experience as well, even when you were the coolest of cool kids and everyone was trying to give you money. Did that first experience impact the derivative ones?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a bunch of interesting lessons, and I you know, with the bunch of the founders I work with, I share the advice with them, which I'm like, there's only a few pieces of advice I give, which is one, it's much easier to get a divorce than it is to get rid of a board member.
Yes, that is very true.
So I'm like,
there's legal recourse to get rid of divorcing, and there's not with board members.
Exactly. So I'm like, you know, however much time you spent picking your spouse, think just as hard about picking your investors. So, you know, because I think a lot of founders go and be like, well, I'm just going to pick whoever writes the biggest check. And you're like, you don't know if that also means you picked the biggest asshole.
He's totally. Totally.
Right?
Like, or what their standing is within their firm, or, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
What their motivations
are.
What's
their network? What expertise do they have? How
helpful
are they?
What are they underwriting to, and what false pressure or things are you going to get put on the business because of that?
Exactly. So I'm like, rule number one to me is like, make sure whoever you pick, you're happy working with them for another decade.
Yeah.
You know, because I now have board members like Glenn who have sat on our board for more than a decade.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a great relationship. And I'm like, man, imagine how painful the last 10 years would have been if you had an adversarial relationship with your
yeah.
board. Right. So I think rule number one, you have to like the people that you're working with, right? And have a deep sense of trust and respect mutually. Right. Two is I think it's super dangerous to maximize valuation.
Mm.
So we were always very conservative about that. Yeah, we had offers for, you know, bigger checks at every round, but we never optimized for that. Because going to the point you made is like, well, what outsized expectation does that set on our execution?
Mm.
Right? Because yeah, you can go, you know, and you see it. You see these companies will take $1 billion valuation at pre-revenue.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, well now guess what the expectation is for your growth? Right. Like now it's all or nothing. You gotta go all in on, you know, on growth and hope you hit a stratospheric number, or you're going to have massive down rounds that has implications for all your employees, because you're going to issue options to them that are all underwater. It's going to be super demoralizing. You're going to have to do a down round. And if things go sideways, it eliminates your optionality on what the outcome could be.
Yep.
Because an acquirer is going to come and look and say $1 billion for a $0 revenue company. Like, are you insane?
Yeah.
Right. And I've seen that, right, where great companies and great teams, frankly, get stranded because their valuation's so sky high that there's no exit. Mm. Right? Like, no acquirer wants to touch them, and you're not far enough along to be public. So what happens?
Mm.
You know? So I think there's super high risk in just saying, I'm just going to chase maximizing valuation. And at the same time, I think that thing impacts like who you think about as, you know, being the folks you want to work with.
Yeah. Whenever I say this, it sounds very much self-serving and like I'm talking my own book. So it's appreciated when founders actually validate these things as well. So thank you for that. I guess it's hard to know the counterfactual on the product and the coupling and the integrating into the suite a little bit more. You obviously don't know the road not taken on it. I'd be curious on the very bundled side of the house, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, and then the other side being totally federated, independent, separate products in there. I don't know where you think of where you landed. It sounds like there were shared workflows and services between the two. Where were you on that spectrum, and what were the we've talked about some of the benefits, but what were the trade-offs or considerations that might be non-obvious that were negative in some way?
Yeah. You know, it's super interesting, you know, and it's like, I look back and I'm like, are the things I would do differently now? Probably, with hindsight, you always have that luxury. I think some of the biggest trade-offs is things like, what is your development efficiency, right? Obviously, we had to duplicate some work because you now have more products rather than less, right? Two is you end up with more inconsistencies because you're like, well, this product did it slightly differently than the way that product did it. But if they happen to be the same product, they'd be more consistent with each other. And then three becomes complexity on the user and customer side, which is, hey, we love Terraform. Now we want to adopt Packer, but it's a different tool versus if it was just part of the same logical, you know, platform, right? So I think it creates some of that customer friction. So those are probably the negatives. The positives, though, is it allowed us to experiment and go a lot faster with these things. And almost treat them like a little bit of a laboratory. We can say, hey, you know what? Why don't we try this thing with Packer? And if it's successful, we'll bring that feature to the other products.
Mm.
So it allowed us to actually do a lot of that sort of, I'll call it, you know, experimental laboratory stuff, right? Where we'll say, hey, this, we have a new configuration language, for example. Today we use what we call HCL. It's the HashiCorp configuration language. When we first used that, we did it with one product only. It was Terraform. And it was massively successful with Terraform, so we ended up bringing it to all of the other products.
Mm.
So it gave us this ability to kind of experiment with things that would be a lot harder if you have one platform, because the cost of experimentation would be very high. You can't be like, add this one thing to your one new product. It's like you have to replatform the entire thing to it. So, you know, I think the flexibility of having multiple insertion points was valuable because it was a simpler conversation. The ability to experiment was valuable, right? And the ability for us to iterate a lot faster versus it being sort of a larger platform was great because you're in a market that's highly competitive and dynamic and evolving all the time. So that speed and agility was super important. So I think there's some trade-offs. Now, as I look at it, we're now starting to converge. You know, we actually just did a marketing rebrand on Monday to the sort of notion of an infrastructure cloud. We're really positioning two logical subsets of our portfolio, infrastructure lifecycle management and security lifecycle management. So what we're starting to do is say, hey, how do I take the logical parts of the portfolio that are infrastructure related, converge them together? How do I take the security parts of my portfolio, converge them together, and deliver them as sort of a logical platform?
Mm.
But the advantage is now it's like these are not products that are going 0 to 1.
Mm.
We've gone through that. We did the iteration on product market fit. We know they have fit. We know they have logical, you know, synergy with each other. And we've done a bunch of these experiments. So now it makes sense because you're just in a different place in the market, right? 10 years ago, the market was figuring out what did it need. Now the market knows what it needs, but they're asking us, hey, can you simplify to make it easier for us?
Mm.
So I think that's the other trade-off is you kind of have to understand where are you in a market life cycle, right? And I think you see the same thing, for example, in a lot of the data AI space, right? You know, you think about Databricks early on, they started off by saying, hey, we're going to make it really easy to run Spark because that's the market pain. And then over time, they were like, well, the market also needs a data lake and the market also needs an MLOps pipeline and the market also needs these other pieces. But because it's such a dynamic market, you couldn't have known those things up front. You had to wait until the market needs were clear, build a bunch of independent things, and then bring them together in a logical platform, right? So that's like a great analogy to me in a different market than infrastructure, where as a market's evolving, it's not obvious to anybody, you know, what are going to be the important pieces. So having slightly more decoupling lets you go fast versus if you're trying to build a platform, doesn't make sense. Platforms make a lot of sense once a market is stable. Take Workday. It's not a market that is, you know, you're like, I don't know what HR needs. It's like, well, it's been the same thing for 50 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need payroll, you need benefits, you need performance reviews, whatever. So you start by building it as an integrated platform because you know up front what all the requirements are. It's not a particularly dynamic market, right? So I think that is important. I see often founders make that mistake where they try and go platform too early. I already see it now. There's probably 50 AI, Gen AI platform companies. And you're like, guys, you don't know, you know, what last week looked like was different than what next week looks like in Gen AI. So how are you going to build a platform? You have no idea what the features are even going to be.
Interesting.
Right? So it's like you kind of have to wait until some of these markets play out. And then over time, a platform becomes a natural aggregation.
One of the decisions on the product side that you all made was giving independent names that were disassociated from HashiCorp. I guess one, I assume, how did HashiCorp, the name, come to be? I assume it's a derivative of Mitchell Hashimoto, but how did you guys actually land on that?
So the name is really funny. So when Mitchell started, he basically had a bunch of contracts that were ready to go to do some consulting work around Vagrant. So he needed a corporate vehicle to basically sign these contracts under. And he had been doing personal consulting under his LLC, HashiCorp, because it was just a one-man LLC just for his personal consulting stuff. So he's like, oh, well, I have this LLC. I'm just going to sign these first few contracts for Vagrant under that. And then together we can brainstorm what we actually want to name the actual company, right? Rather than just my, you know, one-man LLC. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. Let's just get going on those contracts and like, we'll figure out the name. So we spent a few months thinking about like company names of like, well, what would we want to name the company given this bigger mission and what we want to do? And, you know, at the time, if you remember, this was when it was very like in that everyone's startup name was missing letters and like your logo was like a cute animal or whatever. Yeah. And we sort of hated all of that. We're like, so the brand ethos was always luxury defense is always what we went for, right? Like we wanted to feel like mission oriented in the way like you think about a defense company is, but luxury in the sense that it's like attention to detail, craft, polish. So we wanted something that would convey that. So our logo always was, you know, symmetric, sharp edged, right? It was not a cutesy animal. And what we liked about HashiCorp is it sort of sounded vaguely, you know, vaguely dystopian, right? Like you think about like Tyrell Corporation or like, you know, Fuji Heavy Industries, right? Yeah. It has like that kind of a vibe to it. And so we liked that because it kind of fed into that sort of luxury defense vibe. So we spent a bunch of time thinking about names. We couldn't come up with anything that we liked better. And at some point we were like, honestly, we have more important things than the name, like whatever, let's get on with the product stuff. So it just stuck.
That's funny.
So it was just one of these like happenstance, coincidence type of things.
Well, and then on the product side, it's interesting because in some ways, I imagine, I've had this experience before where people won't know HashiCorp, but they will know Vault or Terraform.
Correct. All the time.
I'm sure you've lived that way more. And so I would say conventional wisdom to disassociate your company name from your product name, that's certainly unusual. That is not what I would say most Silicon Valley venture investors would recommend. So what were the considerations and the puts and takes on that?
Yeah. So it's funny. So it goes back to what I talked about earlier, which was like we wanted the optionality to divest without us hurting the brand. So we actually took it to an extreme in the early days. In the early days, each of the product websites was totally distinct. They had different fonts, different colors, different branding, different logos. The only way you could tell they were HashiCorp was like the copyright in the footer in gray text was like copyright HashiCorp. Like it didn't even say HashiCorp anywhere on the websites. And so this was very much a deliberate strategy because we're like, well, we want to launch this thing. What if auto fails? Then we can quietly kill it and nobody will realize that it's sort of related to the rest of the portfolio. Now you flash forward a few years and we had exactly that problem. We'd go to customers and they're like, well, I've never heard of HashiCorp. And we're like, well, we make, you know, Vagrant, Packer, Terraform, Cosmos. And they're like, oh, we use all of those things. And you're like, and you don't know us. And they're like, yeah, we didn't realize there was one company behind all of them.
Yeah.
And so we're like, okay, this is, we've clearly created a problem for ourselves. So this was probably around 2017 that then we did a major flip on the brand to say, okay, all of the websites we're going to update to go to a consistent look and feel. We're going to bring them into a sort of a single color palette. We changed all the logos to make them much more, not the same, but to follow a isometric grid. So they all have a similar pattern to them. And then all of them got relabeled. So instead of just Terraform, it's always HashiCorp Terraform. Instead of Vault, it's HashiCorp Vault. So the websites became a lot more HashiCorp branded, and then they had a common HashiCorp banner that would link back to the homepage. So we made a big deliberate flip around 2017, 18-ish, to bring them all into much more of a consistent framework. But even now, years later, we still have people who are like, oh, I used all these tools and never heard of HashiCorp. So it's one of these things where it's like the early decision actually gave us the flexibility to be able to kill products like Surf and Auto, and it worked. You know, we were able to kill those things without it causing a reputational issue for us, right? Because in the early days, we wanted to be able to do that experimentation. The downside is it created some of this brand, you know, recognition issue that for the most part, I think has been resolved, right? Like it used to be every meeting, they had no idea who we were. You know, now it's like, I don't know, maybe one in 50 that they don't know that it's all linked back to HashiCorp. But, you know, it took years.
So maybe not something you would overly recommend. It made sense at the time. Is that a fair distillation of all that? It's probably caused some more headache than benefit.
Okay. I think we were more worried about the brand impact than, frankly, the reality was like people understand you're a startup, you're experimenting with things, not everything works. We would have been better off having it all under the HashiCorp brand to begin with.
Makes sense.
You know,
your market had some being open source and being your monetization model and all that. There's maybe a little bit of uniqueness to this, but I actually think the point is probably broadly applicable in that your users were often different than your customers in some ways. And I don't know if that's the nomenclature you would use for it, but the number of people that were using one of the products versus paying for one of the products were wildly different. And even if you're at an organization or you're an entrepreneur listening, and it could just be your buyer is the C-suite, but your individual user is someone different. And there's trade-offs and considerations for who you're serving, how you reach them, all that. Can you maybe talk to me a little bit about that and landing on how you built product for who and where? And then ultimately monetizing and how you thought about that for who and how.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what makes open source monetization hard. And I think a lot of companies get this wrong, is exactly, you're right. Our user is not our buyer typically, right? Our user is developer, downloaded our product on our website or GitHub or whatever. They're just trying to solve whatever pain point they have. It's their boss or their boss's boss who is saying, how do I have a consistent multi-cloud strategy? How do I manage the risk of my developers doing something stupid and creating a security vulnerability for me? How do I manage hundreds of applications in a cost-effective way? That's a buyer consideration. It's not a user consideration. So we very much took the split approach of saying our open source and our community-focused efforts are focused on the user. How do we solve their problem in a way that's elegant that they're going to like? But our commercial focus is actually on what the buyer's concerns are, which is how do I think about managing risk, managing cost, managing sort of complexity at scale? It's a different set of concerns. And then our sales motion is really geared around get to those champions who are your user, have them sponsor you to get to whoever it is, the director of infrastructure, VP of infrastructure. And then you can position to them the commercial value prop, which is, hey, your developers already love us. What if you standardize on our technology and we can solve all these other problems for you, right? And so it was very much a bottom-up motion in terms of the adoption is bottom-up, but we have an outside enterprise sales team that drives those conversations at a director, VP, C-suite level.
I assume from where the business started, and at one point you were pursuing your PhD, right? Or you were going to go down a path of academia?
That was the intent. Yeah, I didn't get very far.
You didn't get very far along the way. I assume you didn't grow up thinking you would have insights around enterprise sales and platform sales and all that. Maybe as you dove into that or got exposure to it, what was the most surprising learning or something that was just counterintuitive to you that would be interesting to someone listening about, you know, big deal sales and all that?
Oh, man. I feel like I got multiple MBAs worth on this. You know, I think there's maybe two things, which is like one is, I'll share maybe the most surprising thing. And then two is like, how do you actually learn this stuff and sort of make it work? Probably the most surprising thing to me, I'm like, guys, it's 2020. Does anyone really like buy software over a steak dinner at a golf course? Like, you know, surely that was like, I don't know, 80s power lunch with two martinis.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, you're like, that's what my mental image of this stuff is. And then, you know, I literally cannot tell you how many steak dinners I've had over the last 12 years. It's probably, I will have cardiac arrest 20 years early as a result.
Gout.
Yeah, exactly. And quadruple bypass, I'm sure. Because it's still done over steak dinners at a golf course, right? And I think it goes back to the earlier point, which is it's about trust. And so much of this is, it's not about the steak dinner, right? Like, that's kind of irrelevant. It's about, you're taking this customer, you're spending time with them. You know, you're going to do the meeting in the day where they're going to say, tell me about the features and the business case, and we'll go over pricing. Sure. But it's the dinner where they look you in the eye and say, can I bet my career on you? Because that's what's happening, right? There's a VP who's saying, I'm betting my career on you. Can I do that? Help me feel good about that, right? And that's what that dinner is. And so you end up realizing that, yeah, you talk about software and you talk about cloud, but at the end of the day, the adoption is deeply human, right? And that's why that won't change. And, you know, I think, rumors of us moving everything to, you know, we're all going to be doing sales deals over Zoom is, I think, vastly overblown, because at the end of the day, it's about human trust, right? And so I think, to me, that was the interesting lesson where I was like, that's like such a kitschy, you know, nobody does that anymore.
Tactically, obviously switching the language from Twitch of like, we will make you successful versus I don't know. It sounds like that was one way of actually operationalizing that. It also sounds like lots of red meat helped along the way. But were there things stylistically that you figured out helped in building that trust beyond just FaceTime and being there in person and presumably being honest, but it sounds like maybe not overly honest, honest with a touch of, you know, confidence inspiring too.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the other interesting thing is these markets are very predictable in terms of who are first movers, who are the risk takers, and how does the dominoes fall? And what I mean by that is, you know, once we had brought in some senior executives who had built go-to-market motions, right? And we can talk about, you know, bringing in Dave as our CEO. One of the things you end up realizing is there's a playbook to this stuff. So for example, you're going to go enter Singapore as a market. There's a sequence of buyers, right? So you're going to go in and say, hey, the first organizations I'm going to go sell to are a specific set of banks because they're the risk takers. They're the front edge of technology investment. And when you land those few banks and those few telcos, everyone else in that Singapore market looks to them. So if I can land them, I go to the next customer along and say, hey, you know what? The bank up the street, they're our customer. And they say, oh, really? Okay, well, if they're doing it, then great. We feel comfortable. So you end up realizing there's this very repetitive domino effect, right? In the same way, if you can go land Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, then you go to the next bank along and say, hey, by the way, Goldman and Morgan use us. And say, oh, really? If it works for them, then it's going to work for us, right? And so there's this sequencing of, you know, you have these early adopters, they set the sort of trend, if you will, for the market, but they're also the ones that other people look to later on in the curve to de-risk their decision, right? Because a bunch of the middle enterprises are not going to be the first movers and the risk takers. They're going to kind of look to their peers. So that was the other interesting lesson, is that it can't be pray and spray in terms of a sales strategy. You have to enter these markets and say, okay, I'm going to go win this account. I'm going to go win, you know, Barclays Bank, because they're going to be the first one in the UK, but they're going to let me get to Lloyd's, right? And Lloyd's is going to let me get to, you know, so on and so forth, right? And these markets are just very predictable in sort of the sequence of who are the early movers.
The go-to-market staffing across the different products, you mentioned like there was kind of a throughput of a DevOps buyer, but some things are more security oriented, as you alluded to. Some things are more, you know, software development lifecycle oriented as well. And so did you all end up building different sales teams to focus on different products, or did everyone sell all the things in the bag? How'd you think about orienting the sales team?
So we went through a number of evolutions on it, right? So originally we were too small to have, you know, any really notion of multiple sales teams. So it was a single core sales team. And we had a single common pool of solution engineers, our technical sales folks. And that was really the early days. Most of our focus was Terraform and Vault at that point, right? As we got a little bit bigger, we actually introduced the notion of an overlay sales team. So then we had a specialist set of sellers and a specialist set of SEs just focused on networking with Consul. Because ironically, even though infrastructure and security seem more distinct, it was actually networking that was the, you know, more distinct of a sales motion. So our overlay was really focused more on Consul at the time. And then over time, we realized actually the sales motion side of it is pretty similar. It's the technical side that's more distinct, right? So then we sort of folded the sellers back into the core. And now we have a notion of what we call sort of generalist SEs versus specialist solution architects. So we have our solution architects that sort of specialize in different domains, infrastructure, security, et cetera, networking. And so that's kind of the way we sort of specialize it today.
We've shifting gears a little bit. We alluded to different points along the journey, but you and Mitchell were at the University of Washington together and best friends over the course of 4 years. He started working on, you guys were at Keep together, then yep. he started working on Vagrant on the side. Is that the
so
right?
So Vagrant actually started at University of Washington.
Oh, he did? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So Mitchell came to me with this idea. He was like, hey, I want to build this thing, Vagrant, to simplify setting up my developer environment. And he was doing all this stuff to try and isolate the app. And I remember, because like this was maybe 2007 or 2008, and he didn't know about virtualization at the time. And I was like, hey, have you seen this tool, VirtualBox? You can actually create like a VM on your laptop, and like you could probably put your whole dev environment in the VM. And I remember Mitchell's like, oh, that's really cool. I'm going to go like research it. The next morning when I saw him, he's like, I rewrote all of Vagrant around VirtualBox. Like, this is going to be the future of how this stuff happens. And, you know, to Mitchell's credit, it was the future of how that stuff happened.
Wow. And so that started then. And then did he recruit you to Keep, or?
He did. Yeah. So that was the whole, you know, the funny thing was basically we both moved to the Bay Area, but for two very different reasons. Mitchell went to join Keep. I went to go get my PhD at Berkeley. And Mitchell would pester me nonstop. You know, he would text me 1,000 times a day being like, hey, you have to interview, you have to meet the team, you have to kind of, you know, chat with them. And I was like, I don't want to go to industry. I want to go to academia, but I'll make you a promise. I will do one interview if you stop pestering me about this. You know, and so I should thank him for being so persistent, you know, because I did do an interview with that team, and it was my first real startup exposure. So it was the first time I met a team that was like, you know, it was at the time 7 or 8 people, you know, a very cool kind of environment right in Soma, really like, you know, a fun building culture. And I was like, this is really cool. I could really have a lot of fun here. So I ended up deferring at Cal for a year to join the startup. So I never even started there. I just deferred to join Keep. A year later, they called, they're like, you have to make a decision. Are you coming back? And I'm like, I'm having a lot of fun. Berkeley's not going anywhere. So I ended up dropping out to stay at Keep. And then, you know, a year after that, you know, Mitchell left, and then I left shortly thereafter to HashiCorp.
Huh. So, you all spent, I mean, friends for what now 17 years or something, dating back 07, 08.
Yeah, exactly. Back like to 07, yeah.
And you worked together from 2012 to 20, I mean, I guess in some capacity still today, but formally through Keep and HashiCorp. How long was that journey, like formally working together?
I mean, it was 2 years at Keep, and then Mitchell left late last year, so 23, so call it 10 years at HashiCorp.
Okay.
So,
in what ways did you all complement each other? Were there clear overlap areas that or was it kind of perfectly symbiotic?
You know, I think we had both different strengths that we brought to the table, right? You know, Mitchell was always a developer's developer. He still is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think he brought a magic touch in terms of developer experience, really being close to how should the tools feel? How should they work? What's going to create a really magical experience? And he pushed us really hard on a bunch of things like, you know, that time to value has to be less than 5 minutes for the tools. And how do we make it really a single command line to really start, you know, using the tools and seeing it. And so there was a lot of things Mitchell really pushed us on from a user experience to kind of really, you know, surprise and delight was kind of the way we thought about it.
I've heard he credits like his Apple retail store experience for some of this.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Having worked there, I don't know, high school or college or something.
Yeah. So he worked there during college. And I think Apple's very religious about some of this stuff, is that notion of use, surprise and delight. And so he brought a lot of that ethos to the product building. And then on the other side, I was always more of a distributed systems junkie, right? And like, that's what I wanted to go get my PhD in. And, you know, I've always, you know, that's what I did my undergrad thesis work in too. So I was always a junkie on the distributed system side. So I sort of was focused on the back end, which was the architecture of the tools. How do we design them in a way that will be, you know, easy to operate, scalable, you know, elegant in terms of how they work. And then Mitchell was on the front end of like, how do you make the experience, you know, easy to use, magical, beautiful. So it's like, it was a perfect sort of, you know, complement of like, I'm going to make the back end of this thing work. You're going to make the front end of it beautiful, you know, and then we can create a really compelling set of products. And then as the company grew up, our roles sort of very much changed. Mitchell stayed, I call it very much like chief scientist, chief engineer, however you want to think about it. He was very much embedded, hands-on, programmed, you know, 5 days a week. He was very much not even a 10X engineer. He's like a 100X engineer. And then I ended up taking much more of the management responsibility, right? Because just as, you know, small startup, someone has to be,
sure.
You know, someone has to be at the helm. And it was one of those things where I would never say I loved it. I would not describe myself as an operator, but it was like I maybe disliked it less than Mitchell.
Yeah. Well, to that end, so you all passed the CEO title back and forth. It seems like playing hot potato for a little bit on who was CEO, and then you decided to be co-CEOs. And then at some point along the way, maybe the totality of the journey, were you communicative with the board and the investors? Hey, neither of us really like that job specifically, and we're going to want an outside CEO? Or was that an evolution of playing hot potato back and forth?
You know, it was definitely an evolution, right? So for the first, for the first year or two, we were so small that like CEO was a nominal title. At some point, once the team got to like 10, 15 people, you need full-time management, right? It just can't be chaos if everyone does whatever they want. So at that point, it was when we were sort of hot potatoing it back and forth. And then, you know, at some point, me and Mitchell had a conversation where we're like, okay, like Mitchell, it's clear you hate this role. Like, why don't I just step into a more of a full-time management role? And so, you know, we sort of formalized that. Maybe we were around 12-ish people or something. Mm. And
prior to that, you guys were like switching every quarter or something?
Every month. It was like, you're CEO this month, I'm CEO next month. It worked about as well as you thought it would.
Yeah, that sounds like a very, something that I would not recommend to people.
You know, there's a reason it's not a widespread pattern.
Yes, yeah.
So we did that for a bit. It clearly didn't work. Then I was like, okay, Mitchell, you hate it, I'll just do this. And then sort of that was sort of the pattern until maybe we got to about 40-ish people. And that was right around our Series B when we started deciding to say, hey, you know, it became clear to us that, and this was right around when I said we were starting that soul search, right? The board started to push us and say, what's HashiCorp the business? And so we went through a number of different decisions. One decision was, hey, when we grew up, are we an SMB-oriented company or are we an enterprise-oriented company? And I think pretty quickly we made the decision we want to focus on enterprise because that's where the budget is. That's where the problems are technically interesting. You know, so let's focus there. So we made that decision. Then the second sort of question became, well, what's the products? And I think, you know, we struggled with a bunch of commercialization models, right? Because open source is not a well-understood model.
Sure.
So we went through a bunch of different things, ultimately landed on sort of an open core model, which has been sort of the predominant way we've monetized up until we introduced cloud services. But then the third question for us was like, well, who leads this company? Because now we're saying we're going to build an enterprise sales motion and build an enterprise go-to-market as two people who have never worked for an enterprise, sold to an enterprise. Like, you know, could we figure it out from first principles? Maybe. But that's a pretty high-risk approach. So that's when we sort of engaged with the board to say, hey, we think we need help on a leadership side. It wasn't necessarily that we were looking for a CEO, but we were like, we need someone who has done this, right? And so we weren't sure what we wanted. Is it a CMO, COO, president, CRO, you know, whatever. So we brought in an exec search firm, and that's what we told them. We want that. And the search firm had no idea what to even do because they're like, you want a COO, CMO, CRO, president? Like, yeah. What are you, like, these are different jobs.
We need a grown-up that knows enterprise. And
that was our job.
That's a hard spec to hunt for.
So to their credit, you know, they didn't tell us we were total idiots to our face. I'm sure they thought that. But they basically put a whole bunch of different people in front of us with very different profiles, like a CRO, a COO, CEO, whatever. And we ended up hiring a CMO for a number of reasons. It didn't work out, right? So we basically said, okay, back to the drawing board. And then having spent a little bit more time, we're like, okay, we're being a little bit unreasonable. What we really need is actually two very different people. We need a VP of sales who comes from an enterprise background. And then we need someone who understands the marketing side of it. And then we're open to that. Is it CMO, COO, president, whatever? So we said, actually, let's run two separate searches because now it's obviously much more constrained. So, okay, we can do a VP of sales search. Those people are easier to find. It's a well-defined profile. So we ended up finding this guy, Rob Abbott, who ended up joining eventually to be our first VP of sales. And then in parallel, we were looking for much more of a focused, someone with a marketing expertise who could help scale and scale the company. And through that process, we ended up meeting Dave McJanet, who coincidentally knew Rob Abbott quite well from their time at Hortonworks. And so when Rob was talking to us, he's like, hey, I'm thinking about taking this job at HashiCorp. He called Dave. I was like, what do you know about these guys? Like, you know, am I crazy? And we'd had a chance to meet Dave, you know, previously when he was joining GitHub.
And that was a part of the marketing search, although he wanted something bigger at that point in time. Is that right?
Well, Dave was at the time he had gone to be CMO at GitHub. So he had done he was CMO there for a little bit, and then Rob called him, and Dave was, you know, transitioning out of GitHub. So he was sort of an EIR at Greylock at the time. And so when Rob called him, he's like, oh yeah, I know the HashiCorp guys. I talked to them like, you know, 18 months ago. He's like, let me re-engage with them. So then we already had this parallel search going for marketing. Huh. So we re-engaged with Dave. And then it became this sort of, you know, two in a box, basically. We ended up saying, okay, what if we hire both of you guys? You've worked together before. You know each other. Dave brings a deep set of marketing experience. Rob brings a deep set of sales experience. And they know how to work together with each other. And so it almost became a package deal. They started within 2 weeks of each other.
Wow.
And it just so happened that Rob knew Dave and called him. And that sort of reignited that search, basically.
In seeding that role, the responsibility, the title, did you have the ego element of like, oh, I'm giving up this CEO title and this is the canonical thing for Silicon Valley startups and I'm going to give it to someone else to come in? Or was that not something you were thinking about?
So I would say it was a struggle, but not for that ego reason. I think when we started the search, we were actually, you know, the conversation me and Mitchell had was, hey, what title are we open to? And are we open to CEO? And the reason that was important is because the search firm was very clear. They're like, if you're open to the CEO title, that opens up a different pool of candidates than if you're not open to it. And so I think for me and Mitchell, the conversation became, it's like, again, what are we committed to? Are we committed to the title or are we committed to the success of the idea and the company? Mm. Like, what's more important to us, right? Like, you could have the title and the company doesn't succeed. Is that more important to you than not having the title, but you see the company succeed? And what was very clear to both of us is like, we didn't care about the title. Mm. It's like, you know, and in fact, the CEO job is a terrible job. Mm. I don't wish it on anyone. So, you know, both of us were like, we're more than fine being CTO or, you know, VP Eng or whatever else it needs to be. Neither of us felt that strongly about the CEO title. So that was actually not the hard part. The hard part was, you know, and very much, I think at the 11th hour, we got cold feet on the Dave decision. It was, you know, it was, you're giving control away of your baby.
Yeah.
You're bringing in your boss, you know, fundamentally in some way, you know, you can think about Mia Mitchell's reporting to Dave. And they have a seat at the board. And so it's like, they're not like any other employee where you're like, if it doesn't work out, you can cut your loss and move on. Getting rid of your CEO is an ordeal. So I think that's what gave us cold feet at the 11th hour was like, hey, are we going to lose control of the business? Mm. Right? Like, what if Dave's not a good fit? What if there's a cultural clash? What if we don't agree on strategy?
Mm.
And I'll never forget, I had a great call with Glenn Solomon where I called him and I'm like, you know, I can't do it. I don't want to give up control, you know, not for the title, just like, what if something goes wrong? And Glenn walked me off the edge because he's like, hey, listen, at the end of the day, this is you and Mitchell's company, right? Like, it doesn't work without the two of you. And so if it doesn't work with Dave, like, you have our backing. There's like, there's not a world in which we'd like are going to pick, you know, to keep Dave over you and Mitchell if things go sideways. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And so that was a super important call that I will never forget because it was like, okay, having that support and that assurance of the board was like what got us over the hump because we felt great about Dave. We were like, we think he's the right guy, but like, but what if?
Mm.
Like, what if it doesn't work? And what happens? And so it kind of got us over the hump. We ended up making that call and bringing Dave in. Honestly, I look back, it was probably one of our best decisions.
And so it was a year-long kind of vetting process for someone.
Depends how you are you measuring from the first time we did the exec search or the second time?
Yeah, well,
I
guess when you were most amenable to a CEO coming in.
Yeah, that process was probably, yeah, six to eight months, probably.
Was there anything beyond just time that got you comfortable with the person specifically in Dave, or like what was the actual vetting process?
Yeah, I mean the early dates, I use dates because it's sort of that's how it felt like. You felt like you're sort of dating someone, right? Because you're like, let's go to dinner, let's grab drinks, let's like spend time together to understand like how do you see the world?
Yeah, drive-in movie.
What?
Drive-in movie.
Yeah, exactly. So it very much felt like we were dating for a few months. Which was funny because at the time I was dating my now husband. I'm like, sorry, I need to go see my other boyfriend.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, it did have that vibe. But then what we said is like, okay, well, how do we make this real? Because you can only get so deep at a dinner. And so then we started setting up a bunch of whiteboarding sessions where we're like, let's just bring Dave in and read him into the real problems. Mm. Like, hey, Dave, this is a product strategy question, or how should we think about marketing this? Or what's the right positioning for some of these things? And they were true working sessions, like as if he was an employee, like we're just going to give you all the context. Let's work through it as if we'd work together to understand what's our true working style on some of these things. And like, you know, can we add value to each other? Do we conflict? If there's a conflict, how do those things get navigated? And I think what became very clear is Dave has a very similar working style to we do. And it was just like, okay, this is just very easy, right? Like, it's very collegial. There's high respect. There's high trust. Like, you know, it was a very good dynamic. And those were honestly more valuable, frankly, than, you know, the dinners.
Interesting. I heard on Dave's side, at least, he kept asking you all the same questions over and over again. And it wasn't because he forgot what you had said previously. Actually, quite the opposite. He was trying to validate that you all actually saw things the way that you had said it previously, and you were putting on a dog and pony show. Can you maybe talk about, like, from his vantage point? And because it's obviously a mutual sale that's going on, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think Dave was colored by some of his experiences he had at other companies, and maybe, you know, most recently coming off of GitHub. So I think the things he wanted to pressure test with me and Mitchell was, like, where does our actual conviction lie in building a business versus building a cool thing that we like?
Mm.
Because again, it goes back to that thing is, like, are you obsessed with the problem or are you obsessed with your solution? Because I think from Dave's perspective, he's very much a market sort of driven person. He's like, I see the market need here. The problem space is very clear. The opportunity is really clear. What's unclear is, are you and Mitchell going to die on the hill of you think Surf is the best things in sliced bread? Or if it doesn't work, are you willing to cut losses and be pragmatic? So I think what he wanted to understand is, where's our passion lie? If we have conflicts on some of these things, can we resolve them in a reasonable way? Or are we like, no, every hill is a hill we're going to die on, right? And, you know, get a sense for us of, like, okay, is it, you know, how flexible is the passion in terms of being able to direct it to customer interest? And what's our appetite to build an enterprise sales motion? Because I think that was one of the challenges they had at GitHub, was it was like, hey, we're bottom up developer led. We don't want to build an enterprise sales force, right? And that was a big point of conflict for Dave, was it's like, well, then why am I here? That's like, you know, either we want to build an enterprise go-to-market or we don't, right? The halfway house doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what he wanted to pressure test, was like, hey, if we bring in salespeople and they start to change the culture because it's going to be an enterprise sales culture, how do you feel about that, right? If we need to evolve products, if we need to reposition things, right? Like, so I think those are the things he kept asking over and over, I think, just to get a sense of, like, hey, how pragmatic are we and where's our conviction on these things?
Can you maybe take me through your personal journey once Dave came in? Like, what did you go do then after that? And what did Mitchell go do then after that?
Yeah, so I think what started to evolve is, like, Dave's focus very much became go build the go-to-market motion. Because when he came in, it was ground floor, basically. Like, effectively call it no marketing, no sales. I mean, we had one or two salespeople. We had some marketing that we kind of put together, but it was nothing polished or, you know, enterprise grade. So he was like, I'm going to go focus on building that out and building the executive team. So then he started to bring in our head of finance and customer success and support and HR and all of those things. So he's really focused on build the E-team, you know, build out the marketing function, start to build out the sales function. You know, we had Rob Abbott at the time who joined as sales. So he was, you know, hiring and building out a sales motion. So they were really focused on that side. And they kind of deferred to me and Mitchell to say, you guys go figure out the product strategy. But we worked very closely with them on thinking about, how do you monetize open source? What's the, you know, enterprise set of capabilities we should be thinking about building? But he sort of deferred the roadmap, the execution on the actual product side to us. And then between me and Mitchell, you know, Mitchell is very much, I'll call it, like, you know, our chief scientist, right? So if we needed to, like, hey, we really need this, you know, Sentinel policy as code capability for Terraform, great, go put Mitchell on this thing. It's a strategic high priority project for this. He's going to go help build it. Versus I spent most of my time with sort of product management and engineering leadership on, like, what do we need to go build? Who do we need to hire? How do we sort of staff for these things? So it ended up being a really nice balance where each of us had a pretty clear swim lane of, like, where can we add value? And there was really not much overlap.
There's this adage I hear from experienced CEOs, operators like yourself, that they definitely regretted hiring too late for certain roles. I've heard you allude to this at different points. If you were a founder thinking about hiring for a specific role, how would you go about deciding if it's too early, glaringly too late, or the right time to bring in someone experienced into a specific seat?
Oh man, it's so hard. It's such a hard question. I think by the time you're thinking about it, it's a good sign that it's too late already. It's like, that's my general experience. By the time I'm like, we really need that person, you're like, yeah, that means we needed them 6 months ago. that was my general experience of it. I think the other thing that's really helpful has been finding mentors who have seen the movie before. That was, I think, the thing we really didn't have prior to like Dave joining. Obviously, we had people in our network, but it wasn't the same. They weren't close enough to the business. I think once we had Dave in, he's like, well, I've seen this movie from zero to IPO multiple times. And he's like, he could just be like, oh, we need to go hire a head of customer success. And you're like, really? We have like four customers. Like, do we need a head of success? Like, what are they? Who are we making successful? But, you know, he was able to see like, yeah, but you have to build this machinery because it's going to take time to bring that person in. They have to build and train their team. You have to build a process. So by the time it gets going, it takes, you know, 9 months, a year for that machinery to exist. And by then you're going to wish you had it. So I think having some people in the boat who've seen the movie, super, super valuable. And then one of the first things he did was really build out an E-team who had all seen the movie, right? So, you know, finance and HR and success and sales, et cetera, marketing, who had all done it. And so those people knew the playbook of like, okay, at what phases do you need it? So I think our biggest misses were probably in that earlier phase prior to when we didn't have Dave, where it's like, me and Mitchell just didn't know. First time founders, we'd never seen the movie. By the time we figured anything out, it was often, you know, it was often late because it was glaringly obvious.
One astute observation that I guess I practice it implicitly with companies I'm on the board of, but I never heard it articulated as crisply as you had, is that the leaders that you found to be most successful in their specific roles were the ones that could also forward plan or project their org charts and be able to talk about how everything fit together. Can you elaborate on that point and why that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's so hard is if you haven't seen the movie, there is these breakpoints in scale, right? The thing that makes sense, 0 to 50, is different than 50 to 100, different than 100 to 300, 300 to 500, 500,000, so on and so forth. And so, especially for a company that's in hypergrowth, you're not in any of those phases very long, right? You're sort of blitzing through them. And so the problem is, if you're trying to discover the right structures by first principles, you're almost two phases behind at any given point. Because by the time you realize something is wrong, it's already too late. And then by the time you figure out what the right answer is, you're already in the next phase. And so you're almost always going to be two steps behind, right? Versus I think the people who've seen that, they're saying, yeah, I'm hiring at 100, but I'm designing for 500, right? And they kind of know what it looks like at each of those two phases ahead because they know it's like there's just a time lag. By the time you hire the right people, bring them in, put the right structure in place, fast forward 6 months, okay, you know, next thing. And you need someone who can get you more than one phase at a time, right? Because otherwise everything's constantly in a broken state.
Did you find people that hadn't been there, done that, that were able to still be cognizant enough about that in their scaling journey as well? Or was that a requisite of people that had had the experience?
No, I'd say we had a bunch of people that successfully scaled through a lot of the phases. So actually, like a great guy, John Benson, he joined as our first SE. So he was an individual contributor, having never worked in DevOps or infrastructure or cloud. So he joined as an individual, was really committed to learning the domain. And then he just kept scaling with the business. Over time, he ran the SE team. Then he ran sort of the worldwide SE team. Eventually, you know, he stayed with us from basically the early days when we were, I don't know, 20 people, all the way through to post-public. You know, he ran a team of, you know, 250 SEs globally, right? So I think there was, you know, individuals like him. We also had another, you know, Kevin Fishner, similar kind of a story, moved through many different roles, became Dave's chief of staff. You know, so we had a bunch of these folks who kind of blitzed through multiple things, even though they hadn't seen the movie. I'd say that's rare. There's not a lot of people who can make it through all those phases. There's a lot of people who went through a number of phases with us, but then you eventually outgrew them and had to swap, you know, other leadership in. I think the key to some of those people being successful was A, you know, very high levels of sort of IQ, clock speed, grit, you know, commitment to learning, but also finding them the right mentors, right? People who had seen the movie and could help mentor them and say, hey, here's my problem today. Here's how I'm thinking about it. What's two steps ahead? So a great example actually was John Benson, our head of SC. His mentor was a guy named Peter Pelosi, who now runs our global sales team. So he ran it at Splunk at a much bigger scale, 10 times our scale at the time, or maybe even bigger. And so he was sort of a mentor to John Benson, and then ultimately helped John scale. And then when John was like, hey, I've been through this ride for, you know, almost 10 years through IPO. I want to sort of go take a break. Peter was like, hey, well, I'm interested in the role, right? And so it worked, but it was like, you know, Peter would have been the wrong, maybe not the wrong person, but, you know, his scale was much bigger than what we needed at the time. He was able to, you know, mentor someone who could get there, But ultimately, we grew to a scale where then Peter was able to come and have a big impact for us too.
In terms of hiring people into the organization, I heard you say that you over-indexed on culture fit.
Yeah.
What does that actually mean? That could be a platitude that a lot of companies could say, like we're very proud of our culture. But I get the feeling that you all in particular sought out people that fit in with your culture. And so I'm curious how you go about operationalizing trying to discover if culture fit exists in an interview process.
Yeah, so this was actually a really important one for us. I think the chief people officer at Netflix once said this, which was, I think 70% of culture is who you hire, 20% of culture is who you promote, 10% of culture is who you fire.
Hmm.
And I thought that was a really good distillation of how does culture get operationalized. Because it's like you can put all the posters you want on the wall, like that doesn't matter. But at the end of the day, it's like, how do you make it real? And it's the people that you're empowering, right? Because they're going to lead by example, they're going to set a tone, and that's going to cascade through the organization. So we really took that to heart. And I think there was a number of influences we had. One, which you might find strange, was actually Bridgewater, right? Sort of somewhat of a famous, notorious hedge fund. But one of the things I think that they do is they're very principled. They actually have a book that they give even to guests, like when we would visit them as a vendor, they would give us their book of corporate principles, and they had like 300 of them or something. And they're very, very detailed about their culture and how it should operate and how they want it to sort of look and feel. And we're like, there's a lot of really great tidbits in that. So I still have their principles book. And so we looked at that, and we looked at a lot of the sort of culture-driven companies that we admired. And we sort of said, well, what's unique to HashiCorp? What resonates with us, right? Because it's not something that you can just pick what sounds good on the internet. It has to be something that you can resonate with and live as a truth. Because otherwise, the company can tell us, like, okay, if Mitchell and Armand don't live it, then why should any of the rest of us? So we sort of distilled down for us what we ended up calling the principles of HashiCorp, which was sort of a distillation of a bunch of like leadership principles that we liked and thought would be valuable. And that became a hiring guide. So the reason it actually existed was for our hiring managers. So long before we published it on the internet, now we share it publicly. For many, many years, it was just something we gave to hiring managers to say, hey, when you're hiring, this is what you're screening for. And we actually had designed specific interviews. So if you had one person who was your technical screen, one person who was sort of the culture screen, it was the principles fit, where we had specific questions about, hey, ask me about a time when you had to be pragmatic about a decision, that you had to change your mind from what you originally thought, because we wanted to test people on, are they dogmatic or pragmatic? Could they talk about it in a product context, right? So we really built it into our hiring, and then we factor that into things like performance reviews. So when we do performance reviews, we look at it through the lens of our principles. Even today, all of our annual reviews, you know, we talk about the principles of the company. And then if people weren't a fit, we were aggressive about pushing them out, because the problem is it would just cascade, right? Mm. It creates collateral damage. So that's really, for us, was super important. It was like, you bake it in deeply to your hiring process. It's still a part of our hiring process, right? You bake it into your promotion review process, and then like you fire aggressively when people don't meet it, right? Mm. And so that's the only way you make that stuff scale, right? Because as I joke, I'm like, you can't have HR police.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things, like once... I wrote culture police here, which I guess maybe I stole from you somewhere. But once you hire someone in, they pass the considerations on the way on the interviewing process. And then it sounds like the annual reviews and stuff mapped against the principles as well. Yep. But how did you go about operationalizing the where there's smoke, there's fire, and yep, potentially cancerous parts of the org? Because that's the biggest thing in this is it's not just the one person you hire. There's the cascading derivatives of who they will hire. Mm-hmm. And then there's the people that look to them and say, well, if this person is able to get away with this, then I'm going to do this as well. So there's so many implications of a single bad hire, single bad person. So I'm curious on like how you actually, you know, managed to put that in practice.
So I think it was two things. In the early days, it hasn't really changed. It's like me and Mitchell were always very accessible, even now. You know, new folks will Slack me or whatever all the time. So I think we always kept a very open door policy, made it very clear that, hey, me and Mitchell are super accessible. If people have concerns on anything, like, come talk to us. I think in the earlier days when we were smaller, it was easier and less intimidating to reach out, right? You know, as you get bigger, it's kind of, people are less likely to ping me and Mitchell directly. So early days, the way it would happen is like, people knew that me and Mitchell cared deeply about the culture. And so when they would see that, because they're on a team and a new manager came in or whatever, people would Slack us. So like, people weren't shy. They'd be like, hey, can we chat? Like, you know, I have some concerns about so-and-so's leadership style or whatever, right? And I would take those meetings and I would take them very seriously. Like if someone came to me with that, then I would go meet with other members of that team to understand, hey, is this isolated? It's just an interpersonal thing, or no, there's like, you know, there's fire there. And so there was, you know, oftentimes those would then lead to action. Like people would talk to me, I'd go in, I'd do the homework. It's like, yeah, this person really isn't a good fit. Okay, let's, you know, have a plan and move them out. As we got bigger, that gets harder. Obviously, it's like I can't be everywhere and people get less comfortable reaching out directly. They don't have a relationship. So the way we've done it is actually it's baked into the same performance reviews. So not only do you do your review, you do an upward review of your manager as well as your peers. And then we do heat mapping. So it's very clear usually. It's like when you run this heat map and you're like, hey, what are their scores from their team? When it's like, you know, when it's orange red, you know, it's very obvious on the heat maps. And so then we can go say, okay, great. So senior leadership is going to go do a bunch of skip levels and go figure out what's going on here. Is it just, you know, interpersonal thing, a team, whatever? And oftentimes what you find is when the heat map is red, there's something there.
Yes. You know? You can manage up and hide a lot of things. It's really hard. Your direct reports are pretty good leading indicators of what's actually going on in the business.
Exactly. So it's like when those things go red, you're like, okay, we those are serious indicators to us.
So we talked about the number of principles and the stuff you guys valued culturally. I enjoy obscure shout outs and references from internet software history. And it sounds like a fairly influential company that is obscure to history at this point, I think, was Basho, influenced you all around integrity, maybe, one of the principles. Yeah. Can you maybe talk about, just to give an obscure shout out to people that, you know, long since lost to history, I think Basho is at this point, but what they did that you admired and how it became a part of some of the principles of HashiCorp?
Yeah, no, that's you've done your homework. That's a great reference. So Basho was a company that we had used their products at Keep when me and Mitchell worked there.
It was a Washington-based kind of...
San Francisco.
Oh, it was San Francisco.
San Francisco-based sort of distributed database company.
Yeah, database, yeah.
And
very cool and influential, albeit not like majorly successful, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, very... There was a hardcore, you know, distributed systems group that would nerd out about it, but it was a niche group. And so we became, you know, friends with them. We were users and sort of their technology. And one of the things, you know, there's many things we admired, but I think one of the things that we loved was their approach to marketing was very no bullshit, right? This was an era, you know, if you go back to 2011, it was very like databases were in, there was a million of them. And most of these database companies, it's like you go to their homepage marketing and it was like they're lying through their teeth, right? It's sort of like infinite scale, unlimited transactions, blah, blah, blah. And then you use this thing and you put three nodes and it falls over and dies. Mm. So you're like, okay, well, you know, where Basho was always very technically honest, very transparent and open about here's our architecture. Here's exactly the algorithms. Here's how it scales. Here's the limitations of it, right? It wasn't just marketing smoke and mirrors, basically. And we love that because as practitioners, we felt like, this is genuine. No software is perfect. We're not asking for perfection. We're asking you to tell us what do you do really well and what are the limitations of it, because that's what you need to know as an engineer. Like, I can work with your strengths and I can work around your limitations, but what I can't do is, you know, live in la la land of magic and mysteries, right? So we loved that about that. And then their focus on the technical operations, making it a really elegant software in terms of how do you run this in a simple way? How do you upgrade it? Because those are often the hard parts of software. It's not just the day one setting it up. It's like, I have to operate core infrastructure like a database. If it goes down, it takes my application with it. Mm. You know, how do I make this simple for my operators who have to do this stuff? So we loved that side of it, their passion for the operations teams and how you make this stuff easy to run, their honesty, their openness about, you know, technical architecture, their approach to community sort of engagement. So all of those things were things we admired and were very much things we tried to incorporate. And, you know, for us, for many years, you know, our products, if you would go to our websites, we would say, hey, how does this tool compare to the competition? And they were all very honest. We would put these things in open source. They were not meant to be FUD, right? And so we would encourage our competitors often, if we were wrong, hey, send us a pull request on GitHub, fix any factual inaccuracies we have, right? And they often did, and we would accept their changes. And we were trying to say, hey, here's our strengths. Here's why our philosophy is different. Here's how we've benchmarked it. You know, here's how it stack ranks, you know, strengths and weaknesses, right? And we tried to be very, very honest about those things. And that very much came from the work we did with Basho.
Hmm. Tao of HashiCorp. Can you explain to people what it is and how it came to be and what it's done in principle?
Yeah. So the Tao of HashiCorp, sort of the companion to the principle. So if the principles are sort of how does the company operate and the people operate, the Tao is how do the products operate?
Yeah, the external versus the internal.
Exactly. And so for us, when we started to build all these different tools in the portfolio, even though they're different tools solving different problems, we had a common worldview is maybe the way to put it. It's like, hey, we think infrastructure should be managed like this. So you could almost think about our Tao as a little bit of like our manifesto of like, how should infrastructure be managed? What's the HashiCorp view of managing infrastructure? And so it identifies a bunch of these sort of, I'll call it design decisions, right? Around, hey, we believe in immutability. We believe in a focus on workflows over specific technologies, things like that. And so we sort of codified those as part of the Tao and published those. So customers would know, hey, here's the design philosophy that we sort of follow. But they also became our internal design guidelines. As we were building new products, we would look to the Tao and say, okay, well, how are we going to design around workflows over technologies? How are we going to be pragmatic about, you know, integrating with whatever technology the customers need us to, et cetera. So it became this sort of twofold internal guide as well as an external, how should you think about the HashiCorp ethos, basically.
Mm. Has it stayed consistent?
Amazingly, we haven't changed a thing on it, and wow. I'm not sure I would change a thing
wow,
on it.
Wow, that's
right?
Amazing.
So
how did you go about actually coming up with the inputs into it then?
You know, it's I think some of it was just a deep-seated set of beliefs from being an operator of like how this stuff should work. Some of it came from just kind of, I'll call it practical business sense maybe, of like, you know, pragmatism is a good example of it. We saw a graveyard of these companies that failed because they were dogmatic, right? And so some of them just come from, you know, looking at what other companies had done. You know, I interned at Amazon for a little while, so we looked at some of their leadership principles as well and took some of those in. So some of it was just learning from what are the great things you see from other success stories around you. How do you incorporate some of that? And honestly, you learn from the failures too. You say, okay, well, what made them fail? Okay, you know, these were the things that went wrong. How do you sort of avoid those? And then others were just from a practitioner standpoint, like what do we value as engineers? And so a lot of what we focus on is sort of an elegance and simplicity of it, a, you know, a singular focus of these things, a composability of the tools. So it brought a lot of things like the Unix philosophy into how we think about building tools. And that just came from being engineers working with other tools and saying, we really like that about these tools that we use. And we dislike these things about other tools that we have to use.
One of the things I heard you specifically worked on as a leader, manager, operator was communication.
Mm.
And I think it was both written and verbal, but I don't know. I guess one, why do you think communication is important for leaders in, maybe some of the non-obvious things around that? And then how do you actually go about working on being better at it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, in many ways, I think about communication as a second order consequence of execution. And we talk about this even in our principles, right? We say execution is one of our principles. But if you think about execution, at the end of the day, it's about how do I make every individual at HashiCorp successful, right? You have thousands of people. So for them, they need to know each and every day, what is the thing that I should be working on that's going to be most impactful to the business? So, okay, there's either two answers. Every single day, I should ask my boss that question. Who should ask their boss that question? And so on and so forth. Or you have to have a communication strategy where it's clear to every single person, this is the strategy. This is what's most impactful. This is what I should be working on. And that's a distributed decision that everyone is making to drive the execution in a consistent way, right? And I've seen many cases of this go wrong at a company where you don't have that consistency and marketing team thinks this is the most important, engineering team, that's the most important, sales team thinks the third thing. And so every part of the company is executing a different strategy fundamentally. And it you can tell, right? The pieces don't come together.
Hmm.
So for us, we said, okay, for it to work, you have to have a tight communication loop that's bidirectional, meaning it's top down in terms of this is vision, this is strategy, this is what we're going to go execute in. And that has to be top down because otherwise it's inconsistent. Like it can't be a bottom up. Everyone defines the strategy. But you also need it to be bottom up in terms of, well, what's the feedback loop? We might say, great, we're going to build Surf. We think it's a great product. Let's go pitch it to customers. We go in product and earn in market and customers are like, well, this thing doesn't make any sense. It's too complicated. Okay, well, you need that bottom up feedback loop to be able to adjust your strategy and change course, right? So communication to me, I think about it through that lens. Then when you step back and say, okay, well, we're a remote business. What's the best strategy for communication? Synchronous doesn't work, right? We have people in every time zone. So you have to optimize for something where you're like, okay, it has to be asynchronous fundamentally so that people can consume it at their leisure at any time. And then importantly, when you think about a company that's growing rapidly, you have to assume 50% of the people at the company a year from now have no idea what you said today. Hmm. So how do you keep it so that they can, like, do you want to do the same town hall every week? Right? Or do you write down the strategy? Right? And so we have a very strong written culture. In fact, we even wrote our own internal document management tool that searches and indexes and categorizes all of our internal documents, because we have something like 4,000 internal memos.
Wow.
Right? For different product strategy decisions, marketing decisions, this and that. So very, very important for us is that we have this strong written culture. Everything gets written as a set of documents. They're broadly distributed by default. They're open to everyone at the company. And we've built tooling and process around how do you distribute this. Then for me personally, you know, and then a lot of people, I think, struggle coming into that because they're like, they're not necessarily comfortable as writers or good writers. And so I think what we coach people on is two things. One is, I'm not asking you to be Hemingway, right? Like, you know, this is utilitarian. You're trying to communicate a decision, a context, a set of ideas. Like, I don't need incredible prose and perfect sentence structure, right? Like, it needs to be, you know, good enough, you know, for government work, right? So I think it's taking a little bit of, like, you know, making people comfortable that we're not grading you here on prose. And then two is providing a lot of convention and examples. So when they come in, we point them to, here's a bunch of examples of what good documentation, good RFCs for us internally look like. Mm. And then we give them tools like, you know, templates and things like that. So it's like, it's not an unstructured thing. It's like, hey, you explain the problem first. You explain the context. Then what's your proposal? What are the alternate ideas you explored? What's an adversarial view? You know, there's a template that walks you through the content I expect to be in this document. So it becomes over time, I won't say formulaic, but it's like, you know, you kind of, there's guardrails on what we expect the document to be.
Last one from me. One funny observation that I heard from you is around airline loyalty and that being actually a big unlock for you at a professional level. And I love this observation because it's actually something I've realized as well recently. And so I'd love for you, I can give my own version of events around it, but why being loyal to an airline has been professionally beneficial to you as a as an executive at a company?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really funny one. You know, I used to have none, as you said. I used to just be like, whatever's the cheapest direct flight, whatever. I'm just
same way. I wouldn't even think twice about it. If it was Spirit Air, I would try to get the big seat, but I would, you know, that's it.
Yeah, it's like whatever the flight is, I'll just take it. I think at some point when you start saying, I'm going to do 250,000 miles a year, you're spending a lot of quality time at airports. And so what I started to realize was like, okay, when you actually have status, it's not like the free peanuts matter, but it's like shit goes wrong when you travel that much. And the airlines have a very different experience for you when things do go wrong, right? And so it starts to be the little things like, hey, this flight got canceled for weather. Okay, you call United on their Premier 1K line. Great, we put you on the next flight out. You're standing on their normal line, you're on hold for the next 4 hours, right? And like by the time they get to you, the plane's already booked out, right? So those little things matter because when you do as many flights as we do, it's like things go wrong. You're like, oh, this meeting ran long. I'm going to miss that flight. Can you put me on the next one? And they're like, yeah, no problem. We'll just do that. They waive the change fee. They put you on it, whatever. So that matters. And then it's like, you know, it becomes the little upgrades of like, oh, great. They managed to get you in business class on this flight. That just makes that experience of that much travel slightly less miserable.
Yes.
It's not like it's not miserable. It's still miserable, but it's less miserable, right? And you're like, okay, when you're doing that much of it, like that little bit of sanity makes a lot of difference.
The quality of life improvement of going from, you know, backseat, middle, bathroom to premium economy, you know, window to business upgrade is like, It's some of the little joys of quality of life improvement that I think can keep you sane in a world of tons of travel. And so I've actually found this to be the case as well. I've moved from the east side of New York to the west side of New York, and now I've had to switch my loyalty from JFK to Newark. And so I've gone Delta to United. But I've learned this exact experience, and it took me a while to get there. I haven't done it with hotels yet. I don't know if you've done hotels. I'm only airlines right now, but that's the next
one. It's the same one because the hotels don't have the same problem for me. It's like because they're not, you don't have the same variability of this flight got missed or whatever.
It's not fickle.
Yeah, yeah, you're
and,
like,
and at the end of the day, the queen beds sleep generally the same, no matter what, if it's a beach view or whatever, a city view or
the
a
difference between a random Hilton and a random Marriott isn't that high.
It's not that big of a difference. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Armand, thanks for doing this. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This was great. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining this episode of the Logan Bartlett Show with Armand Dagger, co-founder of HashiCorp. If you enjoyed this conversation, we'd love for you to share it with anyone else that you think might find it interesting, as we're trying to continue to grow the listenership. Also, if you could subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on, we'd really appreciate it. We'll see you here next week for another great episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. Thanks, everyone.